Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I'm your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Salute to Abu Dhabi show, our salute to Abu Dhabi. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. And here to begin the show on a high note from the University of Kentucky, their communications infrastructure manager, to explain to you about our web presence, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know you can get the audio of the shows at WMKY.org. That's right, WMKY.org. Well, what is that, you ask? Well, that's the Moorhead State Public Radio website. And that's where you'll find all the audio. Now, you will have to navigate a couple of menus, and you'll have to look for the show Health Matters, and don't want you to get sidetracked and go off on something like, you know, Front Page or some of those other shows you might find on that. But once you find Health Matters in the menus, click on it, go to it. There you will find a list of the more recent shows with a summary, with a link to the audio, link to the podcast. We try to digitally deliver Health Matters about 4 days after the show airs for the first time. So certainly, if you would like to have Health Matters delivered to you automagically through a podcast, just sign up for it, and you'll usually see that come through about 4 days after it airs. That would usually, since the show airs first on Saturday mornings, you'll usually see it sometime around Tuesday. So certainly, if you know what a podcast is, then you know what to do. After that, say you want to interact with Health Matters. Say you have, you're fond of us, you like us, or the other side of that coin. Go to facebook.com/HMRadioshow, and there you will find a fan page for Health Matters. Like it. Share it with your friends. Let them like it. The bigger the population seeing that, the more fun it can be. I think we can see all kinds of cool comments. We try to respond to all of them. I don't think we've missed any so far. I think we're pretty good about interacting with the comments and feedback we get on that. We have a couple of people that are particularly fun. Would chatty be the term, Tony?
Chatty.
I don't think chatty's the term. Certainly, we encourage you to submit some show topics, something you may want to know more about, or some questions you may have had, or possibly if you're the Florida Citrus Growers Association, maybe you need clarification on something. You know, I don't know what, but there's all kinds of things you can do to interact with the show. And you can do that at facebook.com/HMRadioshow.
Our sponsor for today's show, Counting Moles, much healthier than counting crows. There is a simple melanoma risk test that we want to tell you about. This is from Medscape Medical News and came from the Department of Epidemiology, King's College London, and also from researchers in Australia. Published online October 19th, British Journal of Dermatology. A person's risk for melanoma, it does involve how much time you spend in the tanning bed, how many sunburns you got at an early age, but it also involves the number of moles on your body. If you have more than 100 moles on your body, the risk increases by around 5 to 6 times that of the general population. Now, we're not talking about pimples. We're not talking about other blemishes on your skin. We're specifically talking about moles. This research, they found after looking at 3,600 twins, almost 3,700 twins, average age was around 47 years old. They looked at their skin type, their hair and eye color, their freckles, and then they did a mole count on 17 body sites. And they found, overall, the average number of moles on these 3,700 twins was around 32. They get over 100, their risk of melanoma goes up. They found that if you have more than 11 moles on one arm, you are likely to have more than 100 moles on your entire body and a higher risk of melanoma.
Mole. So, Tony, are you an 11-mole guy?
No. I have, at my age, I'm starting to get a lot of things that I don't understand happening to my skin. There are these little red things that come up. There are all sorts of things that I'm not fond of, and innumerable.
Now, but do you wish you went themselves back and been a dermatologist?
No. Of all the wishes, of all the regrets in my life, not being a dermatologist is not going to be one of those. But the point is, you know, it's very difficult, actually, to count the number of moles in a person, over a person's entire body.
One, sounds like a very personal thing.
It is personal. Two, it is keeping count is somewhat difficult, I'll put it that way. And it is fairly easy. And so if you are wondering, count the number of moles. And remember, 11 on one arm corresponds to over 100 on the entire body, and see what you get. I'm just looking at my arm right now, and I see 3, being generous.
Yeah, but you got long sleeve shirts rolled up, so there's a lot of your arm that's not visible.
Fair enough, but I don't think I'm going to get to 11 on that.
I don't know, man. Your underarm could be bad.
Well, it is, but that's not
because there's
point
a lot
of
it there.
At any rate, that's our sponsor, Counting Moles, much healthier than counting crows. Our salute to Abu Dhabi begins with fun facts about Abu Dhabi. Abu Dhabi, the capital and second most populous city in the United Arab Emirates. I remember that as UAE on the globe. The largest of their 7 member emirates. According to historical accounts, Rick, you may want to know this. Abu Dhabi was first used more than 300 years ago, meaning father of the gazelle. Although some people called it Dhabi, which is mother of deer. Not quite as elegant as father of the gazelle. On the west coast, they call it Abu Dhabi. On the east coast, they pronounce it Abu Dhabi. Lies on a T-shaped island jutting into the Persian Gulf. City had 1.5 million in 2014. It's the seat of the government, as I mentioned, and home of the president. It is the country's center of political and industrial activities, accounts for 2/3 of the $400 billion UAE economy, and it is the 68th most expensive city in the world.
Most expensive
city in the world to live in.
Really? See, I would have thought that would have been Dubai.
Oh, Dubai's pretty expensive. I mean, you're in the top 68. I'm fairly certain that Dubai would make the top 100 as well. I've heard Tokyo is number one, but that's not a salute to Tokyo, so I don't know for sure. Fun fact number 7, Abu Dhabi has a hot desert climate, sunny blue skies throughout the year. The months of June through September, temperatures average maximum temperatures above 100 degrees during that time, sandstorms and so forth. Record high 121 degrees. November to March, the cool season, dense fog and highs of 76 degrees. Now, you might ask yourself, why is Health Matters doing a salute to Abu Dhabi?
Tony, why is Health Matters doing a salute?
You know, and I thought you would ask yourself that instead of bothering our radio fans with asking that, but I see that's not so.
It was a softball. I lobbed it to you.
Thank you very much.
Hit the thing and move on.
Number one, Abu Dhabi is probably the only world capital that my grandson can pronounce at age 5 months.
That's not true. That's not true. Can't say Fiji.
Oh, see how hard it is for a baby to say Fiji?
There's multiple syllables there.
He's going to get it eventually. He's already doing his B's and his D's, and so he's going to get it eventually. And by the way, before my wife corrects me, his age is actually 8 months. I apologize to everyone
in
my
terrible.
Family. I know.
You're terrible.
I was just making up a number.
How do
and
you
I thought
continue
five,
doing this?
I'm a bad grandfather. Now, here's the other part about Abu Dhabi you need to know. This was October 26th, the journal Nature Climate Change, and as you might imagine, it is a journal on climate change. According to their projections, worst case scenario, the temperatures in Abu Dhabi, and I mentioned the highs were in the 120s, will probably reach 135 degrees by the end of the century. And it is conceivable that that area, because it is low-lying, because it has no cloud cover most days, that area could reach temperatures of over 150 degrees, which would make it uninhabitable. Basically, when you get up to those temperatures, aircraft do not operate properly during takeoff. The rail system starts to expand and bend. Machines don't work properly at those temperatures. So, ironically, this is a place, obviously, they made their riches off of oil, but if climate change continues where it is, then they may very well become uninhabitable, the very climate change that some scientists feel that their oil generated. Also, this same peninsula, of course, contains Mecca and the 2 million Muslim pilgrims who go pray outdoors from dawn to dusk near Mecca. This could make that extremely hazardous if temperatures get up in the 130 degree range. This is something that we just have absolutely no experience with. Our salute to Abu Dhabi, a city that I will probably not visit in my lifetime, and we may not be able to visit in future lifetimes. Now, maybe you can't save the planet, but there are some things you can do. This came from Amsterdam in the Netherlands. Rick, you've seen those guys who are out on the connector during rush hour running along the shoulder of the road.
Yes.
And I have always thought this is the worst health idea I can imagine, getting a hefty dose of carbon monoxide for your afternoon run.
Right. And you're running kind of into traffic, because that's a safe thing to do. So
Back in September, there was the European Respiratory Society's International Congress 2015 met in Amsterdam, and they were looking at something called black carbon. It's a part of air pollution, especially coming from diesel vehicles, and they measured levels of black carbon particulates while walking between London and a place called Moorgate near central London. And again, they used the main roads, and then they went a quieter route in the same time period that might have a lower level of pollution. solution, and that's exactly what they found. Walking the busy route six times between February and May produced measurements that were approximately 40% higher than if they walked the quiet routes, a statistically significant difference in the peak exposure of black carbon between the two routes. Now, you know, I don't necessarily know that we have to measure black carbon levels, but I would urge people, particularly during the warmer months, when you're out running, either avoid rush hour, avoid peak traffic, or avoid those roads that carry peak traffic.
But you and I just avoid running.
Well, I will walk, but I will say I don't walk along a busy road.
You walk to your car.
At work, yes. But, you know,
you walk to the barn.
At home, I've got plenty of quiet roads to walk along at home. That's not an issue.
Yeah, but you walk them with a purpose.
Most of the time I do. Yeah, I mean, that's true. But my problem is exercise should be about improving your health, and swallowing large amounts of carbon monoxide is not improving your health. Either stay away from rush hour or stay away from the main roads, even in a small town like Moorhead. You don't want to be taking these fumes in. And it's especially a bad time to get your exercise during rush hour traffic. That's all I'm saying.
Plus, there's a lot of people looking at you.
Oh, that's
a problem. Tony, I don't think either one of you. I don't think you or I are graceful runners.
Neither one of us is going to be dashing through Morehead State's campus with our shirts off anytime soon.
Not without getting sighted.
If things go according to plan, put it that way.
Yeah, I would get a ticket. We won't talk about for what. No, we're not going to talk about it, Tony. We're not going to talk about it. You move on.
Now you have planted visual images in my mind. I don't know what to do with that. That
just
sounds
run along.
Rather interesting.
Run along. Just keep going.
But don't run in traffic. That's the point. I'm going to start something here, and we may not be able to finish it because you.
No, no, no. We won't be able to finish it.
Okay.
Let's just be honest.
All right. So
let's don't lie to ourselves.
All right. Once again, we know that texting while driving. We suspect that texting while driving is a distraction.
It would appear as though it would seem to be a distraction.
Yeah. Now,
one would think.
Yeah. And the question is, obviously,
if the state law allowed it, we could try to test that theory.
Right. But the state law doesn't allow it. Texting while driving is a distraction. Now, how distracting is that? Rick has always said, how distracting is that toward eating a cheeseburger? Should we, in fact, ticket people who eat a cheeseburger while driving? Should we? And I'll go further. What if you read billboards alongside the road?
It's somewhere between programming your navigation and eating a cheeseburger. It's somewhere in between there.
Yeah. The point is, there are a lot of distractions, and when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about the new in-auto systems. There was an AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety study that addressed the distraction of these voice-activated systems in your car. We'll tell you more in our second fractional portion. Meanwhile, take a break, run around in some clean, low-traffic place, and then come back for our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is our salute to Abu Dhabi, the city on the Arabian Peninsula, the capital of the United Arab Emirates, and a city among many in that area where temperatures may, on a regular basis, reach over 130 degrees if our current climate change continues, according to projections. Our sponsor for the second time, Counting Moles, much healthier than Counting Crows. That's right. Counting crows. I did that badly.
Crows.
Well, it almost rhymed, and I wanted to make it rhyme.
Do you like the Counting Crows?
No.
The band?
No.
You don't?
Not really a big fan.
Okay. So basically, you've never heard their music?
No, I've heard it.
Okay. You say well, so. If you say so.
You say it,
I believe you, Tony.
Okay, fine. But I no. I just I think, well, I can.
You probably listen to it while you run, don't you?
I could live with it. That's right. Every time I go running, I put on Counting Crows. That's why I am not a fan. This was the study of 3,700 female twins, average age 47 years.
Now, is it 37 total people or 3,700 sets of twins?
3,700 total people.
Okay.
And their average age was 47. They took part in a study in the United Kingdom between January 1995 and December 2003. They counted their moles. And then they asked themselves, is there some way we can approximate the total number of moles on these people? Because we know if you have more than 100 moles, that itself is a risk factor for melanoma. This was in the October 19th British Journal of Dermatology. They found if you have more than 11 moles on your arm. And they looked at right arm and left arm. They were pretty close to being the same. Legs not quite as good. And as Rick mentioned, legs were a little more personal than arms. You can do a mole count on the arms. If you have more than 11 moles on your arms, you are likely to have more than 100 moles in your entire body. If you have more than 100 moles in your entire body, that raises your risk of melanoma by around 4 times. So we feel this is an easy thing for a person to do. You or someone you love can use a mirror or simply using direct visual confirmation, count the number of moles on your arm. Most of us are only going to have a handful. It's also interesting, the number of moles do not stay constant. There are fewer moles as a person gets older.
So, Tony, we're talking about moles that not necessarily are raised, right? They could just be dark spots, right?
That's right. They are dark spots in your skin. As I said, not pimples, not scars. But they
could be raised, or maybe they are, maybe they're not, right?
Either way. Most of them flat. Average overall number of moles in your total body is 32, so obviously you're not going to have 11 in one arm. This declines steadily after age 30 years. 4 nevi per decade. 4 moles per decade between ages 30 and 60. So you start with 32.
Just think, Tony. We've been together for 6 moles.
When you put it that way, it's so romantic. I love it. That's our sponsor, Counting Moles, much healthier than counting crows, and also a little bit easier to listen to. We were talking about basically the voice-activated technology system, the entertainment systems that are in the
cars. We were talking about distraction as text messaging. I don't think we'd quite made it to the voice systems yet.
Now, the thing is, these voice-activated systems, you think to yourself, well, they tested these systems, right? They did test them to see if they worked. When you say...
But they didn't test them to see if they were less distracting.
That's correct. And it turns out, if you are thinking about getting one of these systems, you really ought to drive a Mazda 6. That's not because the Mazda 6 is good. In fact, the Mazda 6 has the highest distraction rating of any car with a voice-activated entertainment system, according to the Foundation for Traffic Safety from the AAA.
Oh, that seems kind of weird. Why would the model car, just because of the way the human interface is set up?
Right. That's absolutely right. They make you think more than the others. Now, it may be because the Mazda 6 has more features. It may be because it takes you more screens to go through, steps to go through to get to them.
I will admit, my very first Toyota I had back in, 2006, had a Bluetooth feature. It had the ability to work with the phone. It had a lot, but it required you to always push a button and then talk, and then it would say, "Did you mean this?" And did you? And it was really a distraction because it was a nuisance. But you know, in my most recent iteration of between the phones and the technology in the cars, now they don't do all that. Usually, they just talk to you. You don't even use that feature, do you?
I do, actually.
You, really?
Yeah, I certainly.
Your car talks to you while you're driving down the road?
Yeah. Matter of fact, I call my mom.
Oh, well, yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. Hands-free is, I think pretty proven to reduce distraction, right?
Yeah. Obviously, you don't have to look down where what your fingers are doing, which is kind of handy. But still, they mentioned this. I thought this was really interesting. It takes 27 seconds for a driver using a voice-activated entertainment system to regain full alertness after making a command. That's a long time.
Yeah, that's a long, long time.
I don't understand that. Well, I don't know what you're doing for the 27 seconds. Apparently, I suppose you make the command, and then you have to do something to assure that the command's being carried out, so your mind apparently wanders to whatever you commanded. And perhaps you're thinking about the counting crows and how much you hope that when the radio comes on, they won't be on the radio. Or perhaps you're wondering if the radio will come on or whether or not you have to give another command to get to the station that you really wanted to listen to. I'm not sure. But they said 27 seconds after you use a voice-activated system before you regain full alertness. And then this is according to the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety. Now, I'll just go with the most distracting is the Mazda 6. A rating of 4 or higher is a very high distraction. It was a 4.6. Next up is Microsoft Cortana. Are you working with Cortana, Rick?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's a 3.8. Cortana apparently is worse than Apple's Siri by a little bit. Cortana 3.8, Siri is 3.4.
Well, I think the difference there is, and I've witnessed my wife use Siri. I don't have Siri. I'm not an iPhone guy. And what I see there is she tends to talk into Siri in these big, long... And she's a physician, so she is very, very comfortable with transcription, right? So she's been dictating her entire life. So it comes natural to her. So, you know, she knows when it's time to put a period in there, you know, when to put a comma, and she can do all that. And so she takes these big, long paragraphs. She'll literally say three or four sentences into it, and it does a pretty good job of getting it right. And so I would suspect that that's less distracting.
Yeah.
And me, on the other hand, on Cortana, I put a sentence in, I make her read it back to me so that she's got it right, and then she says, do you want to send it, or do you want to add some more? And I say, well, let's add some more. And then with Cortana, it's kind of a dance, right? We're doing a little dance going down the road.
Yeah.
And so while it probably is a little bit more distracting, my texts that go out are probably far more accurate.
Fair enough. Now, let me just say, if you're driving down the road, if you're using Microsoft Cortana, that's a 3.8 distraction rating. Again, 4 is very high. 1 is mild. 3.8 for Cortana, a 3.4 for Siri, and a 3.0 for Google Now. Now, it might be that they just do less. So
I suspect it is. I mean, a lot of cars you get into, they really don't maximize the Bluetooth features of a Cortana or a Siri or that. You know, it's very, you know, they'll stream Bluetooth audio, but that they don't get too deep in the voice activated stuff. Now, right. I'd say moving forward in the newer model cars, that's going to be nothing but, you know, available. I mean, they're going to have to do that in the newer model cars.
Now,
does your car have it fully baked in?
It does, and actually, it's one of the better scoring ones, or it's at least in the class of those. Let's go with cars now. Mazda 6, a 4.6. Off the charts, worst distraction. A Hyundai Sonata, 3.8. Chrysler 200 was a 3.8. VW Passat was a 3.5.
So Tony, let's think about this. Because, I mean, you're naming car models, right?
Right.
So you've just went down and said a Mazda.
Mm-hmm.
You went down and said a Hyundai, a Chrysler. But before, we were talking about Siri and Cortana, which are devices, not cars.
Right.
So what if I take my Cortana and put it in a Mazda?
Well, if you talk to the Cortana, and the Cortana is actually getting your commands, apparently that's going to be a 3.8 distraction. Whereas if you use Mazda's internal system, it's 4.6.
Wow.
And this is how they did it. The study itself, first of all, baseline, if you are focused on the road, that's a 1. If you're listening to a radio, that's a 1.2. They were solving math problems while memorizing a set of words in a simulated driving environment. That is a 5. So somewhere between watching the road and doing math and memorizing a set of words and trying to drive, that's where all these systems fell out. Now, again, if you go to the low end on the cars, Chevy Equinox, a 2.4, Buick LaCrosse, a 2.4, I've got a Chevy, Toyota 4Runner, a 2.9, Ford Taurus, a 3.1, Chevy Malibu, a 3.4, and then the VW Passat was the 3.5. So they tested a few models from different companies. It looks like basically GM cars, Ford, and Toyota look decent in their systems, whereas, again, the Hyundai and the Mazda and the Nissan actually were among the highest. So the point that they at the end of this, they said some of these systems haven't been well engineered and thought through. People have an assumption that if they put it in the car, they've tested it for safety, and in fact they may have tested it to make sure that it will change your radio station or read your email, but they have not gone further and tested whether or not these systems are safe. Something to think about when you buy a car with a new system.
I do think that I would love to know from a stance of, you know, what exactly defines a voice-activated system? Are you, you know, telling the car to make a phone call? Are you telling the car to receive a text message? Or, you know, I am kind of curious as to what that means and if the 2.4 low number for the Equinox has the same feature set or the same. I mean, I would love to see all the underlying data, which they didn't provide for this study, just to see how that lined up.
Yeah, I understand.
And the other thing, too, now what would be cool is if you could overlay the distraction with cheeseburgers and passengers and
trying to figure out where the next
kids.
The next hotel or restaurant is by watching the billboards on the side.
But I would want to do something that's not, I mean, nowadays, Tony, we're going to show our age here. Nowadays, you don't look at the billboards for the hotel. You just don't. You've pulled out that voice-activated system and said, where's the closest hotel? So, I mean, I don't think the billboards are going to be near the distraction that, you know, something like a passenger or a cheeseburger or, I mean, there's probably things like that. You know, another thing that can be very distracting, the other drivers on the road. Have you ever focused on somebody who's driving so bad you're paying more attention to them than you are what you're doing? You know, because you're kind
enough.
Of, I mean,
yeah,
it's a defensive driving thing, but at some point it distracts you, the driver. So anyway, I think I'd like to see that in comparison, you know, because, you know, I'm a kind of a protector of technology. I don't like to see technology's name smeared in the mud. And, you know, I mean, they could certainly take the Siri and move its numbers higher. I wouldn't care. But but I would be curious to see how this technology solution correlates to other functions that happen in the car that require, you know, that instigated a distraction.
I think at the very least, if you're test driving a new car, you've got to test this system out and see how difficult it is to accomplish some task.
Don't you do that? I mean, I don't do it from a difficulty. I do it from an ease of use. I mean, it's kind of crazy, but I'm not sure I would buy a car that did not have integrated electronics packages like this. You can't, as a technology worker, I can't function. It's more important to me than the gas mileage.
I would agree with that now. It's a whole different world. And I'm a little surprised they talked about the radio, but I think for a lot of people now, the drive is not about listening to music.
No,
I mean,
absolutely not.
Multiple channels of music. People are trying to accomplish things while they're on the road, and these systems are sort of built to nourish that and to help with that, but they may not be. Again, there is this conundrum that automobile dealers, if they don't do something, you're going to bring your phone and you're going to work through your phone.
Absolutely.
And your car. So what they have to do is to figure out a way that is better and safer than your phone, but the testing of those systems is still pretty primitive.
Yeah, now, and what do you do for the new, like, I know that, I mean, I'm not picking on Chevy, it's just they currently are the ones that are advertising having a Wi-Fi hotspot. Now, anybody who knows anything about their data tethering plan, they can have a Wi-Fi hotspot anywhere, including driving down the road. So Chevy's not exactly doing something that's groundbreaking here, but it is kind of cool to sell a car that has one of its features is it has onboard internet. If you're willing to pay the monthly fee, we'll give you internet in the car and you don't have to do anything. You don't have to tether. You don't have to, you know, use your own plan, whatever. I'd be curious, when would that become a distraction to the driver? I mean, how many drivers are going down the road playing Minesweeper?
But if you have kids and you can get those kids wrapped up in a movie, that is less distraction than about anything else that kids would do.
You mark my words. There will be an accident that, if it hadn't already happened, it just hasn't been publicized. I'm sure it's happened already, but someday we're going to read about an accident where somebody was watching Netflix and hit a telephone pole.
I agree.
Driving is definitely evolving, and you know, I guess that's why we see so much energy and effort being put into the cars that can drive by themselves, because we can train the car to be less distracted.
Right.
Then we will be.
And we both agree that is the long-term solution. The idea that we need every day for millions of pilots to climb into their vehicles and pilot their way from one place to another simultaneously is a bad idea. It would be much better to have to take that the variations away.
I tell you, every car manufacturer, they're all touting it. I mean, you know, you got Tesla, which obviously is a high-end model, but they're talking about having it in like 2 years. You got all these manufacturers that are showing cars. BMW showed some at Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas last year that will drive themselves. I mean, you know, we've been parking by ourselves. You know, the car's been parking themselves for several years now. Tony, I think really we may still be on the air when cars can drive themselves. Now, that's, you know, I don't know if that's a short time or a long time, but it's entirely possible we could still be on the air when
it
happens.
The challenge has been laid down. I will note that challenge, and we will see. Rick's made a prediction here.
Well, yeah, but just tune in. 13 years later, you never know. I mean, you know.
Is it because we just couldn't get off the air, or is it because technology moves fast?
Interestingly enough, do you think roads will be certified for autonomous driving?
Well, I think certainly right now.
Because you couldn't do it in Eastern Kentucky on the back roads.
No.
You couldn't do it.
No. The calculations necessary to take some of these curves safely would be beyond this control system. So I think there will be certified roads. I think there will also be a system built into the roads. You know, there's no reason that they should just be inert asphalt.
Right. I love the idea, and I know we've totally strayed off topic, but I love the idea of using the roads as solar panels and you know, there's some cool ideas they got out there about how to do all this.
So stay tuned on this. There is a safety issue. Right now, we do recommend you test drive your car's voice-activated systems as well as your car's motor and your car's handling and the other things you look for in your new car.
You know what we've done? We've distracted the users for almost a whole, or the listeners for almost a whole segment.
There you go.
Or for a whole, yeah.
We can close this one out with the October 21st issue of the International Journal of Obesity. This really makes you think.
Do we have to talk about that?
It does. Yes. It makes you think, and yes, we do.
Okay.
All right. By age 15, children who received 7 or more antibody prescriptions, they looked at records. This was from, again, International Journal of Obesity from Johns Hopkins. They looked at children who received 7 or more antibiotic prescriptions during childhood. 27% of those children in the study, they weighed about 3 pounds more than those that received no antibiotic. They could even correlate the type of antibiotic with the weight gain. Every time, and I think this is an overstatement from Johns Hopkins, every time we give an antibiotic to kids, they gain weight faster over time. Study leader Brian Schwartz, professor, Department of Environmental Health. The magnitude of the weight increase is modest. It is small. It is 3 pounds. But if you think about this effect multiplied by all these children getting antibiotics, and you think about that going into adulthood, it is significant. And we have time and time again mentioned that there is a gut biome. There are germs that are supposed to be in your colon, in your gut. There are germs that are not supposed to be. But when you take an antibiotic, you kill them all. What happens after that is still really unknown. Do you come back and repopulate with the same germs, or are there different germs that grow in after an antibiotic? This suggests that there is some relationship between killing the germs in your gut and your eventual weight. And another reason to remind us, we do not need to be using antibiotics unless there truly is a health threatening infection. Not every sniffle, not every sinus condition, not every cough, not every sneeze, not every bronchitis needs antibiotics. And we may have hurt our children by prescribing so many antibiotics.
You off your soapbox yet?
Yep. And we're off the air. You need to take a break, and we're going to come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Salute to Abu Dhabi show. We've read some fun facts about Abu Dhabi, a place I have never visited. I am not a world traveler. Most of people who know me well know that. However, I am concerned. Abu Dhabi temperatures can reach over 120 degrees now. Apparently, on a regular basis, by the end of the century, they may reach 135 degrees, according to some projections. We have talked about climate change in terms of more severe storms, perhaps drought in the west, of perhaps rising oceans, melting ice packs. But there will be some of the hot spots in the world, particularly obviously along the southern part of Asia, which may in fact become uninhabitable or marginally inhabitable due to excess heat. That is the name of the show. Our sponsor for the final time, Counting Moles, much healthier than counting crows. I did it again, counting crows. I don't know why I can't say crows, but I can't. 3,700 female twins studied and published in the British Journal of Dermatology October 19th. They counted moles on their legs. They counted moles on their arms. They counted the total number of moles. If the total number of moles is over 100, your risk of melanoma goes up substantially. They found if you have more than 11 moles on one arm, you have a higher rate of having more than 100 moles, which increases your risk of melanoma by around 4 times. And they said, we know that having more than 10 moles on your arms is high risk. Having 2 moles is low risk. So each mole that we increase on the arm means we have 1 more on the body. We have to have more than 100 on the body. Again, at least 4 times the risk of melanoma. And so more than 10 on the arm increases the risk of melanoma, according to the study. So you can find out if you have a high mole count simply by counting the number of moles on your arm or counting the number of moles on both arms and dividing by 2. Do you see how I did that, Rick, with
all the
math and stuff?
I did, yeah. You didn't even take your shoes off.
It's our sponsor, Counting Moles, much healthier than counting crows. Final segment here. This is some depressing news from the Children's Research Institute at UT Southwestern, published in Nature October 14th. You know, let's say, Rick, and I hesitate to take you through even this theoretically, but hypothetically, let's say you were diagnosed with cancer.
Oh, gosh.
And you begin your treatment with for your cancer. What kind of things are you going to do to try to help yourself overcome the cancer? I mean, other than going, obviously you're going to get whatever treatment. treatments to prescribe. Are you going to change your lifestyle to try to help conquer the cancer?
You mean as far as like change my eating habits? And
right.
I think something like that's probably enough to get your attention. And, you know, gosh forbid, I don't want to try this, but I think, you know, I've had struggle with my weight. I've struggled with my eating. I think, you know, something like that, I suspect probably would get my attention and I probably would change some of my eating habits.
Yeah. And that's actually the problem. This is fascinating. Again, from October 14th, Nature, you know, when a cancer spreads, that's called metastasis. The cells break off. They go from their primary site to other parts of the body. And that's how cancer spread, is through metastatic spread. Well, they had some mice that had cancer. It behaved very similarly to human melanoma. And I thought, well, while we're talking about moles and melanoma, let's talk about melanoma metastasizing. They treated some of the mice with antioxidants, and they treated other mice without antioxidants. And, you know, for a long time, we thought antioxidants might actually help you be healthier. So if you had cancer, you may go on antioxidants to try to improve your overall health and get through chemotherapy.
I think we were wrong on that, weren't we?
Well, the problem is metastatic cancer loves antioxidant vitamins.
Ooh.
Yeah, so what's good for you turns out to be even better for the cancer. Now, we've known for a long time that people who got antioxidants seem to be at slightly higher risk of dying. We thought, well, maybe it's a mathematical error. We stopped recommending antioxidants. And again, these were vitamin C, vitamin E, beta carotene. These used to be in vitamins regularly, and we stopped putting them in the multivitamins because they did not appear to improve health. But in fact, they may actually make the cancer, they may actually allow the cancer to handle the stress of dividing rapidly and killing you. That's very stressful on the cancer. Maybe we can help that cancer out with some antioxidant vitamins. You know, the thing that it makes me wonder about, Rick, is maybe we've got the wrong idea. Maybe if you have cancer, your job is to make your nutrition as poor as possible for the cancer. So maybe what you ought to do is just beat yourself up, stay up late at night, and eat junk food, because cancers don't want that. Cancers need protein. They need energy. They need rest in order to grow and divide.
Really? You think they can sell that?
Well, I mean, the whole idea of chemotherapy is, can we do something more obnoxious to the cancer than to the rest of you? And, you know, people take a pretty heavy toll from chemotherapy.
Yeah, but your diet's going to affect everything about you.
Yeah, well, so does chemo.
Yeah.
Your hair falls out. Your appetite goes away.
But it is, in fact, but it is targeting it to some extent, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it targets faster growing, faster dividing cells. The interesting thing about this is antioxidants, again, they should help you with the stress of having chemotherapy. In fact, what they're doing is helping your cancer with the stress of dividing rapidly. And so this study with mice, together with the studies on people, now gives us a mechanism by which antioxidant vitamins could actually worsen the outcomes in cancer. Our advice, our Health Matters advice, again, we've never liked just random administration of vitamins or multivitamins, and we do not recommend antioxidant vitamins to people who have cancer based on this study, certainly, and we're just not that fond of antioxidant vitamins in general. Next up, a bit of a surprise and a bit of mystery. Diverticulitis. Since 2000, diverticulitis has become more common. As a matter of fact, the rate of diverticulitis, with or without hospitalization, has increased 50% since the year 2000, and much more so in younger people. This was from the Mayo Clinic, you know, and they always do these population studies with Olmsted County, Minnesota, which is around the Mayo Clinic. They had 3,200 and change people diagnosed with diverticulitis, half of them women, average age 62. Between 1980 and 1999, they had 115 cases per 100,000, and by 2007, they were up to 188 cases per 100,000. The incident rates for the U.S. population as in general has increased. While we think of diverticulitis as a condition of older people, cases in younger people have increased over time. 12% complication rate did not change, and no idea why it might be on the rise. We talked earlier about the gut biome. And again, the antibiotics in children changing the germs in your gut. This may be a long-term effect of changing the germs in our gut. We've seen this, you know, when I was starting medical school, the most common reason you would be hospitalized for a GI condition was ulcers.
Mm.
People died of ulcers. People had bleeding ulcers. People had surgery for ulcers. Ulcers almost disappeared, and we've got now heartburn and acid reflux as a very, very common presenting GI symptom, and apparently diverticulitis on the rise. We are doing something down there. We are doing doing something to the interactions. Either our food has changed or the germs in our gut have changed. Something has changed about being a human being, and the risk of these various diseases is altering, with peptic ulcer disease dropping and diverticulitis rising. There was absolutely no discussion whatsoever on this paper when it was, at least when it was published online, because we have no idea.
Okay. Okay. If you say so.
I'm glad that we were able to get through that without any of that obnoxious conversation and opinions. Diverticulitis.
I was distracted.
I know you
were. I was
were.
Distracted driving.
I know. Rick was busy asking Cortana some questions.
No,
about how long
I was
it would
not
be before
dealing
get
with
off
her.
The air with the show.
I did a search on obnoxious show host.
Okay, I guess I deserve that. Diverticulitis is an interesting disease. You know, your colon has these arteries that come from the outside and go in.
Please tell me you don't talk to your colon. You said that. You were talking like it was a thing, you know, like it was this, hey, guy, you know. I don't know. You just came off really funny there. I thought, oh, my gosh.
He talks to his colon in his spare time. I have never had a conversation with my colon.
Thank gosh.
I have told my feet not to fail me now.
And knowing you, that's happened on more than one occasion.
Yes. Running through campus with my shirt off. Yes, yeah, don't fail me now.
Now, did you have a chainsaw? When
no.
You never like cut a tree and it went the wrong direction, and so you're trying to run and get out of the way?
Well, you've had those disasters, but in that case, I'm just writing my obituary. That's what I do with that. And I've told my hands to wake up. I've told myself to calm down. I've never talked to my colon. Matter of fact, I don't think I've talked to any digestive organ as I think about it.
Well, after you took that one show where we did that tour through there, who would want to? My goodness.
Yeah.
You'll probably not find that one on the web. So we're referring to an old show that was...
I have not. My kidneys and bladder, we have no regular conversations, nor the body. But let's get back to this. The colon, as a matter of fact, a very interesting organ, because the arteries dive in from the outside in, and they basically go through the colon to give blood supply. And where that artery comes through is a weak spot in the colon wall. So you get these little tiny pouches. They're called diverticuli. They're like little tiny appendixes, and you may have a dozen or you may have hundreds of them along your colon. It appears that we are doing that more. Are we more constipated than a previous generation? Are we eating less fiber? That is one possible explanation. Are the germs and gut flora changing? That's another possible explanation. But for whatever reason, diverticulitis is happening to younger people, and it is happening more frequently over the past 20 years than it was before. Just another interesting fact from your friends at Health Matters. Next up, and this was an editorial published online in the British Medical Journal. Rick, we have talked a lot about what we call fecal transplants.
Okay. And I remember that was an extremely, extremely disgusting show.
But aren't they all?
Yeah.
Well, at any rate, fecal transplants, if you remember, sometimes, and this is, again, where we've kind of got a series here where this is a theme show about the flora in your colon, about the germs that inhabit your colon. If, for some reason, the germs in your colon are replaced with abnormal germs to a vast extent, and this is something called Clostridium difficile infection. Clostridium difficile is a germ that's very difficult, that's not the reason they name it that, but I'll just make that up, difficult to get rid of once you get it. It overgrows your colon after you've had antibiotics, and the only treatment we have for it, which is very unfortunate, is more antibiotics. And again, sort of like the cancer chemotherapy, we hope that we can make it more difficult for this germ than for the other germs. We have tried treating with what we call probiotics. Maybe we can put some normal germs back into your colon.
They get paid to do work.
Thank you very much for that. No, we've tried amateur biotics as well. None of those things actually repopulates the normal germs in your colon very well once you get this Clostridium difficile infection.
Well, then clearly we're paying them too much.
Right. The rates of relapse have gone up as time has passed. The germ is getting more resistant to antibiotics. It's harder to kill this invading germ. And so one of the things we do is we do a fecal transplant. Someone you know, someone you love, or you can get it from a stool bank. I am not making any of this up. You get a sample of stool, and that is inserted into your rectum, and the germs that are in that stool repopulate your colon. We like to do this from family. There have been some problems. We have to make sure that the stool sample doesn't have an infection that's even worse than the Clostridium difficile. The FDA has granted fecal transplant a temporary exemption from its status as an investigational drug. The U.S. has 500 centers now offering fecal transplants, and they're mostly done for these Clostridium difficile infections. You can do it for inflammatory bowel disease and some other things. People are trying it for obesity. We've also reported on this show of a person who got stool from an obese person and wound up gaining a significant amount of weight.
Yeah, injected some bad bacteria.
Yeah. Well, the FDA has not given it final approval because we really don't know the long-term effects of changing the colon flora. We know that apparently, or we suspect that apparently, it could lead to obesity. What else it could transmit? I mean, it's one thing, you know, if we give you yogurt. People have been eating yogurt for a long time.
Right.
People have not been taking in other people's stool for a long time.
That's disgusting. I can't believe you say that.
It is true.
I'm sorry. I have to.
I know. The way you were so outraged, I thought for a moment you actually were serious. I was thinking, well, gee, Rick thinks I'm disgusting.
This is one where it's like any good meet, or well, I shouldn't say good, any meeting I'm in that I want to end. I just don't talk.
So Rick's over there with Cortana plotting on how to basically
I'm trying
pull
to figure out how do we get away from talking about a fecal transplant.
Right. I think the point is, we've actually trumpeted this thing. It seems like a simple way to solve a very difficult to solve problem. The thing about it is the long-term effects are not known. And as I read this, I realized they were absolutely right. We've not been doing this. Most of the other stuff that we do to people, we have been doing something like that for a long time. This
right.
is way different than
way different.
Yeah, I would have to agree. Deliberately infecting you with deliberately colonizing you with someone else's germs. Interesting idea. Some good news, and I will try to get through this quickly. International Journal of Epidemiology, October 9th, 5,000 participants, again from the University of Exeter in the United Kingdom. Would sitting time predict all-cause mortality? We've heard so much that sitting time is linked to mortality. They looked at a study, again, from United Kingdom, 16 years, longest follow-ups in this area of research. They recorded 450 deaths, but there was no association between any marker they had for sitting and for mortality. Sitting itself doesn't seem to represent a risk for early mortality. So the people who have bought these stand-up workstations where you just say, I can't sit. If I sit, apparently I will die. Not necessarily so. Study started in 1985. 10,000 civil servants, ages 35 to 55. 3,700 of the men and 1,400 women identified with 16 years follow-up. And they looked at their physical activity, occupation, leisure time, physical activity, sports, housework, active transport, and adjusted that for socioeconomic status, alcohol consumption, smoking, and so forth. After 16 years, no association. Now, there is an association between exercise, but no association between markers of sitting. So the idea of standing up to avoid sitting, to avoid dying, from this study do not seem to hold up.
How fast do you think you'd say that over and over and over again? Sit up, stand up, sit down, stand up. And then, didn't you just go, you went through a whole big sequence there.
I was completely unaware of it, so I guess I could say it a bunch of times because I did not know I did a sequence. We need to get ourselves off the air, Rick.
Boy, and I really want to. Special thanks to Morehead State Public Radio producer Hunter Reese and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or just visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
according to the CDC, Health Matters is heard incorrectly by nursing home residents up to 75% of the time. They also said the same thing about prescribing antibiotics.
The reasons vary. It may be the wrong show, the wrong time, or just unnecessary Health Matters. But it reduces the benefits of the show. Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week as we discuss whether the pneumonia vaccine is half as good as the old pneumonia vaccine on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.